Joy to see you this evening. I hope your day has been pleasant. Mine has been very much so. I got to go over to Parkersburg today and visit with Arnold Daly. I sure was glad to see him, Chloe. And we had such a nice visit, and he was expecting to come home, and I take it that he has. But I hope and pray he shall have a good recovery. And then I had lunch with Sister Lillian Plum and with Brother and Sister Darty, Francis Darty, who is Lillian's brother and sister-in-law. They're longtime friends of ours, and so we had a very pleasant visit and good time to chat. And then I came back in time to watch a little ball game with Brother Bill, and then to be with the Heasleys and to have such a nice meal and nice visit with them, Larry and Judy, and with Lawrence and Cleo, and then here for the service. So a nice day and got back too fast, only 20 hours in a day. I told one young fellow here tonight that my days only had 20 hours in them now. They just get shorter all the time. He looked at me, you know what, he thought it 24 hours, but his may have 24. His probably has 28, because when you're that age, you know, the day is just so long, and you can't hardly wait till you get 16 and can't wait for Christmas to come. But anyway, now when you get my age, the hours, they're about 20 hours in a day. But anyway, every day is a day of thanksgiving and a day of God's blessings, and I have enjoyed very much being in the Ohio Valley today. The announcement's made. We have missed Brother and Sister Horn. I hope you have a good visit and trip down to Alabama, and we'll miss you the rest of the meeting. Also, it needs to be mentioned that the Girtlers are leaving in the morning, going, I think, over to Missouri. Correct? In the Kansas City area, I think Josh is staying here because he's preaching somewhere Lord's Day, or maybe here, but then other things he has to do. But the other children are going with their mother and daddy over to the Kansas City area. They are, as have been announced, I understand, that they're moving from here this summer sometime. And I just want to say this word, that I wish them well. I'm sorry this week, John and Jonah, haven't got to visit with you anymore. We haven't had time just to sit down and really chat and talk over a lot of things. We didn't get to do that last time I was here, and I was sorry that we didn't. But wherever you go and whatever you do, I wish you well. I pray God's blessings upon you. They're a lovely family. I'm impressed with the Girtley family. They are dedicated husband and wife to the Lord and to each other. And they have dedicated children. They're doing a good job so far with their children. Children have a good attitude toward their parents and toward the Lord. And so having been a preacher now for starting my 47th year in June, if I live that long, and engaged in local work 45 years, I quit doing local church work a year ago. And I preach for a little church in Murfreesboro when I'm there, but I'm not obligated to be there any certain time. I go and come as I desire to in meetings or otherwise, but for 45 years I did local church work. In those years I worked with 7 different churches in local work in a 45-year period. And some of it, well, in fact, all of it was, I think, good, because if you teach the truth and if you live right, then it's good. You don't always please everybody, and not everybody always likes you, and not everybody approves of your way or your manner or so on, but that's really beside the point. It's the matter of doing God's will and of teaching truth and living right and encouraging folks and souls to obey the truth of the gospel. I enjoyed my years of local work, but and I wouldn't have done anything else. I've never looked back with regret on being a preacher. I didn't start out to be a preacher, rather than encouragement to. I had planned to be a doctor and was, in fact, taking pre-med subjects in college when I changed my mind and tried to go the preaching route. And I've never regretted doing what I've done. I think it's contributed not only to my well-being spiritually, but I know it has to my family. And so I've never look back on the work that I've done. I wish I could have done more. I wish I could have helped more people. I found out a long time ago as a preacher that I'm not able to help many people. They won't let me. I would have liked to have helped everybody I could have, but I didn't get to because they would not let me, and I learned, too, that I cared more for their soul than they cared for. If you work with people and they don't care for their soul and they're not really interested in doing God's will, and really interested in going to heaven, then there's not much you can do to help them. And that will be somebody that's already in the church or somebody who's not, because not everybody in the church is really dedicated to serving God and putting the kingdom of God first in their lives. And so we all learned that, you know that, and I'm not telling you anything new, but I did learn that I couldn't help everybody as much as I would like to have helped them. I could not. And I'm still unable to do that, but whatever I could do along the way, I've tried. I'm not standing here saying that I always did my very best, but I always tried to. And made some mistakes. You always will in dealing with people, but we all do that. And God forgives those things if we are sorry and we try to do better. But I pray for this church here that whoever you get here as a preacher, that you will uphold his hands, that you will pray for him, that you will encourage him. Difficult to be a preacher. Difficult to raise good children now. And anybody who comes here should be deserving of your very best encouragement and your help. It ought not be that preachers have to beg people to do their duty to God. So many times people are in the church, but they're not faithful. They're not really dedicated. And we expect the preacher somehow to work a miracle on folks and to get them to do their duty when they're not wanting to do their duty. And so we can't do that. But anyway, I pray that whoever comes here will not only be a fine person, a fine preacher, a fine family, could do a real constructive and a good work here. But I pray that you will pray for them and uphold their hands and encourage them in every right way. And I pray for the Gertlers, wherever you go, John. And Joan, I pray that God will bless your work. It's interesting about preachers. We fail in some places, but we succeed in others. And where we have not done our very best, or at least folks might not think we've done our very best in one place, we go somewhere else. And we just set the woods on fire. So it's just, that's the way it works. And why that is, I don't know. But that's just some comments I wanted to make and to wish them well and to say I'm sorry that I'm not getting to spend any more time with them than I have this week. I really don't want to preach to you tonight. I just want to talk to you. Sometimes folks tell me my talking is better than my preaching. I don't know about that. I just have some rather rambling thoughts tonight. I decided since it'd be home folks here and maybe more of the young people present than would be on a Thursday or Friday night or a Monday or Tuesday, children and their parents and young people growing up, that I would just ramble with you a little while and discuss with you and talk about a number of things that might be of interest both to young people and to their parents. I do want to read three passages of Scripture. I use them Sunday morning. In just referring to them, I did not make any discussion of them. But in the last two verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and the first verse of Ecclesiastes chapter 12, we're told to rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart, and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. So admonitions to young people that we'll look at in some detail in a little bit. It's difficult growing up. It's difficult to be a young person. Mary Neal and I have raised four boys, and they are out on their own. The youngest is 32, and the oldest is 40, soon be 41. Three of the boys are married. The youngest son is single still. He's confirmed bachelor, evidently. But anyway, we went through those child-raising years, and we look back on them with a great deal of joy and a great deal of happiness. Those were very fine years for us. And those are the finest years for you, you parents who have your children with you still. These are your finest years. I'm sorry, I've got a tickling in my throat. Somebody ran over with my water cup that I had up here. So, well, anyway, thank you, Darrell, if you'll get me one. But it's always, we're more aware of problems of youth and the fact that so many young people have difficulties, severe difficulties, along with their parents. But it's always been that way. We ought not think because we're more familiar with problems and that we hear more about them through newspapers and through the television and so on, and that, that this is something new. If y'all excuse me, as long as my throat's tickling like this, I'm not doing much. But anyway, it's nothing new for families to have problems and for young people to have problems. Just before I left to come on these meetings, or really to go to Texas and Louisiana and then on up here, a mother called me on the phone from the church in Alabama where I used to preach. And her heart was broken, and she wished that she could sit down and talk to Marinelle and me, because she learned that her daughter, her only daughter, has several sons, but the only daughter is expecting a child. The daughter is 21 years old, been dating a fellow who was 31 years old. The mother and dad did not necessarily approve of that courtship, but anyway, they never dreamed that their daughter would be immoral. She's been brought up, quote-unquote, in the church. She has good, stalwart family, father and mother. Both of them are teachers in our public schools in Alabama. The father's president of our city council in that town. A family of influence, a family well known. And so now their daughter is expecting a child. And the man refuses to acknowledge it. He says he doesn't know who she's been going with, and he knows that she's the only one. That he's the only one she's dated. But anyway, he refuses to acknowledge paternity, and he's not going to have anything to do with that. So they're not going to insist on anything else. So here's a young lady whose life is going to be greatly, greatly affected and maybe to some degree ruined and hurt the rest of her life in this world to have a child out of wedlock. And now that family is struggling. And the last time I talked to the mother, she told me that they had determined at this point that they were going to keep the child. Their daughter wants to keep the child, but I know what happened. In all cases like this, most all cases, the parents wind up being the rearers of the child and taking care of the child. And so that's just, one of many incidents. When I first moved to Alabama in our first year there in 1981, moved there in 1980, there was a man executed in the state electric chair, young fella, for murder. He was a member of the church over in western Alabama. Mother was very faithful. This boy had been baptized as a youngster, but he got in with the wrong crowd, and he began to rob, and he began to steal. And in armed robbery with a pistol, he took the life of a convenience store lady, and he was sentenced to death. And went to the electric chair in Alabama for his crime, and he was a member of the church. It didn't have to be that way, but it was that way. But the interesting observation was this, young people, that the account said, and the preacher who lived in that area told me, he said it's interesting that once the young boy was in trouble, once he was caught and brought to trial and convicted, his friends and all his associates didn't have anything to do with him anymore. They didn't come to see him. Some of them got lesser sentences, two or three other fellas, but he was the only one got the death sentence. And this preacher observed that in the months of trial and appeal and then execution, only his mother came to see him. Only his mother came to see him regularly. And the last visitor that he had before he made those final steps to the electric chair was with his mother. Our mothers will love us and care for us when nobody else does. There is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother, but there is no love like a mother's love. A wife's love is not like a mother's love. And so many times, even when wives will desert husbands and husbands will desert wives, the mother's love will always be present with her child. You just don't sever that connection of a mother with her child. But I thought that was interesting. But there was a death that didn't have to be. That young fellow didn't have to turn to crime. He knew what was right. He had gone to church as a youngster. He had been taught the Ten Commandments of the Old Testament, and he had been taught the New Testament. He knew what was right. But the problem, young people, is that you can be taken to services. You can have parents who are believers to some degree or another of spiritual strength. You can have a good home life, but if you do not determine yourself in your own heart that you will make proper choices, and you're the one who has to make them. Your mother and dad, by the time you get into the middle schools, used to be called junior high, and then on into high schools, they're not there to make decisions for you. You have to make them for yourself. And if you have not reached the point in your thinking and in your convictions and in your faith that you will do what is right, that you will observe the commandments, that you will live a godly and a sober and a righteous life, if you have not determined that for yourself, then all kind of troubles will await you. And your parents and your friends and your brothers and sisters in Christ will be unable to keep you out of trouble. Trouble comes when I determine that I will not do right. If I determine I won't do right, you can't keep me from doing wrong. If I determine I will do right, you're not going to make me do wrong. You could have a policeman on every street corner in every city, and you still wouldn't make people do right unless people want to do right. People, if they have a conscience against doing evil, they will not do evil. If they do not have a conscience against doing evil, and if they have not already resolved in their heart that they will not do evil, they will do it. And there's not any parent on earth, there's no police officer, there's no system of criminal justice that can keep you from doing wrong if you're determined to do it. It always boils down to a matter of our determination, our sin. I open the door for whatever I do. If I determine to be disobedient to my parents, to the civil authorities, to God, I'm the one that opens the door to do that. You don't open that door for me. That's a determination that I make. If I determine that I will obey the laws of man, that I will obey the laws of God, that I will be true and faithful as a Christian in my relationship with my Heavenly Father, I'll do that regardless of what you do. And so it always boils down to this personal responsibility and obligation that we have. People do not have to do wrong. We do not have to ruin our lives. I was in a meeting several years ago over in Indiana. I'm not going to name the place nor the people. But that morning, on a Sunday morning at the worship hour, this young dating couple asked me if they could talk to me, and they wanted to talk to me just right away. And so we agreed to talk that afternoon, on a Sunday afternoon, and the older man and his wife, with whom I was staying in the meeting, they left home that afternoon and went visiting, just in order that I might have the house to myself with this young couple, and so they came. And their story was that now she was expecting a child. Here they were. He was in his first year of college. She was a senior in high school, and they had already been guilty of sin. They were committing fornication. That's sinful. That's wrong. All sexual relationships before marriage are wrong. They're sinful. Makes no difference how much you think you care for somebody or how much you think you love somebody. When you give yourself, young man or young woman, in immorality, in fornication, you commit sin. It's S-I-N, it's sin. It's sin against God, and it's a sin against yourself, and it's a sin against another person. It's just absolutely sin. And the fact that somebody tells you they love you, and if you love me, you'll do this, is beside the point. That's all wrong because it is sin, period. And this young man and girl, both of them members of the church, had been committing S-I-N, sin. And now here she is with child, and the boy is trying to tell her that she ought to go have an abortion because he's not ready to get married, so you murder the baby, see? You do that. And the girl was saying, no, I'm not going to do that. And so he said, I'm not able to support you. I'm not ready to marry you. I love you, but I don't want to marry you now. And so you go have an abortion. I want to go on and finish college. And I've got to have a job, and I've got to have some income. And so we went through all of that afternoon. And I told them, the first thing you do, young people, don't do that. Don't go kill the child. Don't add sin upon sin. The sin you've committed is terrible enough. Do not add another sin to that, to take an innocent life. And I said, the thing you need to do, you go immediately this very night after the evening service and sit down with your parents, both of you, and talk to your parents about it. Tell them. Tell them the truth about it. And let them be your guides and let them be your friends. Although they're going to be so hurt and so disappointed and heartbroken and grief-stricken, they'll stand by you. They'll be your best friends. They'll help you. You tell your parents. Well, I finished that meeting. I never did know what they did. I went back there 3 years later. Here came this boy in with a baby in his arms and a girl by his side whom he had married not long before. They had a baby too soon, but it was not this same girl. And so I inquired. And about this matter, yes, the girl he was going with, they never did tell their parents. She went and had an abortion like he wanted her to do. She killed her unborn baby. This old boy threw her off, married somebody else, and now has a baby too soon with her. What happened to the girl that talked with me? She's had all kind of mental and emotional problems. She's not married. She lives with her parents. They've had tremendous medical and psychiatric bills. Their daughter's life and emotions have been destroyed. The boy didn't love her. And this fellow now, he's moved to a far distant state and doesn't live there anymore. But I just tell you, it's sin ruins people's lives. Sin will ruin your life, young people. You cannot commit sin and you cannot kill unborn babies and it not affect you emotionally and mentally and spiritually and physically the rest of your life. It'll always be there and you will never get away from it, and there's no way you can put it out of your mind, and there's no way you'll ever, except through forgiveness, some degree of it will be gone. In that same place, it was interesting, there was a couple who'd been married about 10 years. They did not have any child. They wanted a child, but had been unable to have a child. And in a meeting there, I've held a whole lot of meetings. I sort of lose track with that church how many meetings I have held. But anyway, this young couple came to me. He's the son of one of the elders. And he came to me, he and his wife, and said, Brother Cavender, it appears that we're not going to be able to have any children. And if you ever run across someone who is having a child out of wedlock or an unwed mother or someone who is having a child, if you could put us in touch with that person and let us talk with them with the possibility that we might be able to adopt a child from birth, from the time the child is born, we would be so happy. We would appreciate it so much. Well, one other time, many years ago, that had happened. I'd helped a couple get a baby, a little child out in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where we live now. I never dreamed, you know, things worked kind of interestingly and strangely. But we had been home, Mary Neal was with me in that meeting, and we went home, and I guess it was about 4 months that a preacher whom I had not seen, we had supported this preacher in a northern state for a number of years, but I had not seen this fellow for several years. He called me on the phone. I wasn't at home, but he talked to my wife. And he said, my youngest daughter has been date raped. That's what he said. He said she's expecting a child. Said there is no way that we can support the child. And there's no way that she can support the child. And we want to give the child up for adoption. And we thought maybe Bill might know somebody, since he travels around quite a bit, who might want a child. Now, wasn't that something? Well, Mary Neal didn't say, yes, we do know somebody. She said, I'll have Bill call you when he gets back from his meeting. I called this preacher, and he talked to me. And I said, Jim, I said, I think I can help you. But I said, I've got to do it in such a way where you'll not know who these people are, and they'll not know who you are. And so, all right. So I called another family in that church that I have the complete utmost confidence in, pledged them to secrecy, and so I began the process. They got an attorney. The attorney contacted the family, expecting the child. They got an attorney, and then the two attorneys began to work together. The two families never met each other. They never knew each other by name. But it was arranged, an adoption. A little girl was born in the due time, and this couple, childless couple, got that little girl. Last year, I was there in Indiana in a meeting at that place. And here comes this young couple, beaming with a pretty little girl, with a smile on their face, came to services every service. Just the happiest, Bill, we got a child. Did you know we got a child? And they didn't know I had any part in the thing. And I didn't tell them. I said, oh, how pretty she is. And I'm so thankful for you. But I never told them a thing, and I'm not going to ever tell them anything. But they didn't know that my wife and I had any part in all that. But I'm just saying to you, here was a tragic thing, and that in the same congregation. Here is one couple who's supremely happy, even though a girl in another state commits sin and has a child. And here was another younger couple years before in that same church, a dating couple, and they did everything wrong. They did it all wrong. Not anything right did they do. They were guilty of immorality. They were guilty of killing an unborn child. They were guilty of not being devoted to each other. He was guilty of mistreatment of that girl, of lying to her. In every way it was wrong. And now it's the girl that pays the penalty. The boy doesn't try to be a Christian anymore. He's married somebody else. He's in a faraway state. He doesn't try to be a Christian. But I'm just saying to you that their lives are ruined. Young people, this is what the Bible and things like that, and some more of these examples maybe as we talk a little bit, this is what the sacred writer is talking about. So many young people ruin their lives before they ever get started. They never give themselves a chance. You're like many of you, perhaps, you're like the young prodigal of Luke chapter 15. He demanded of his daddy, and you know it's interesting in that parable of the prodigal son that the mother's never mentioned. Daddies in those days had control of family affairs, more strict and more the head of the family than men generally are nowadays. But it's interesting that the mother's not mentioned in that. And sometimes when I read that and when I think about it and even comment upon it in lessons, I just wonder what that mother was feeling all that time. How her heart must have been broken if she was still living. May have been dead, but if she was living, I can only imagine the heartbreak of that mother as regarding both those sons, and especially this younger son who left home. But here was a young fella who chafed at being at home. He grew up, and as he was growing up, the grass was always greener on the other side. It's that way to many young people. The grass is greener on the other side. We're immature. We're not ready to leave home. We're not ready to make our way in the world. We're not ready to fend for ourselves, but we think we are. We're ready to jump the fence, and we want greener pastures, and we want to put some distance between our daddy and our mother, and especially if our father and mother are rather strict to any degree, or if there is authoritarianism in the home, if they command and demand obedience to their will in the home. And so many times young people chaff at that, and they just can't wait to get away from home. They just can't wait to be away from parents and be on their own. But let me tell you something. It's a cruel, big, ugly, vicious, ungodly, hateful, mean world out there, young folks. And you are not prepared to cope with that. Very few people are. You need to stay at home. You need to love your father and your mother. You need to appreciate all that they do for you. Every day you ought to hug their neck and tell your daddy and your mother that you love them. Every day you ought to be able to mother Dad, I thank you for what you do. I thank you for food to eat and clothes to wear and a room in a house and a bed to sleep upon and the opportunity for an education, the opportunity to learn. And then while you're thanking your parents, more than that, you thank God for the whole thing. And thank God that you have some parents who brought you into the world and who care for you and who love you and want to do their very best for you and make sacrifices for you. I don't know how much money my wife and I spent on our boys. I didn't make for many years all that much money as preacher. But on the side, and unknown to anybody except my wife, I bought and sold some land here and there. And right when land was going up, and I made some money, and I was able to educate my children. I never would have sent them to college on a preacher's salary. Never could have done that. And it just so happened that I was fortunate enough to see land here and there for sale when I'd travel about. And I'd go buy it, make a down payment on it, and in 5 years it'd about double it in price, and I'd sell it. And so I made a little money. I'm not bragging or not giving you business advice. I'm just saying something. I don't know how much money our children that we spend on them. Never lavishly. We've always been a conservative family. We've never had a lot of money to spend. But we did want our children to have an opportunity for education. But an education in the context of godliness. I wouldn't give you the snap of my fingers, and I wouldn't knowingly spend a dime on a child's education if they're going to be an infidel or be an immoral person. And our sons understood that. If you turn away from the Lord, and if you turn to immorality, and you turn to ungodliness, anything from your daddy financially will stop. I refuse to use what God gives me to support something that's devilish. Don't intend to do that. But I'm just saying to you that we need young people to appreciate what our parents. My wife and I prayed our daily prayer, along with many things that we prayed about all our married life. Married 4 years, and then our first child came along. And our daily prayer was that we could rear these children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, and that these sons would grow up to serve God and to be devout men, servants of the Lord, citizens of the heavenly kingdom. That's all we ever prayed about, that God would let us live long enough to see our children to be grown. We have grandchildren now coming along, 6 grandchildren. I don't pray that anymore about my grandchildren. God's been good to me and to my wife. We don't pray anymore, Lord, let us live long enough to see our grandchildren grow. The Lord answered our prayer and let us see our sons to be grown and to be out on their own and to be educated and to be able to make their way in this world and in the church. And he answered that prayer. And I don't pray that about my grandchildren because my grandchildren have their parents. But I do pray his will be done in their lives as well as in our lives. And I do hope and pray that those grandchildren will appreciate the blessings of their family and what their parents try to do for them. I think our sons have the same concepts of raising children that they were raised with. I think they have the same concepts about material things that their own parents had. I believe they do. They're giving evidence of it. But I'm just saying that I hope and pray that my children and grandchildren will always appreciate home and will be thankful for the parents that they had and what their parents tried to do for them and the opportunities and advantages we tried to give them, and that they'll have thankful hearts to God and to their parents. Young people, don't be the prodigal. While you're at home, do just exactly what the wise man said. He said, "Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth." He said, "Rejoice in thy youth. Let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth. Walk thee in the ways of thine heart, in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment." God holds you to account, young person, and you will reap what you sow. Any older person who ever tells a younger person, oh, you just got to sow so many wild oats growing up, you just got to do so much mischief and get into this bit of trouble here and there, but it'll all work out. They'll sit down. That's not so. The habits that we begin in early life will stay with us the rest of our lives, chances are. You learn to curse while you're young, and probably you'll be a curser all your life. You learn to drink and smoke and take the dope and commit adultery, commit fornication, be immoral while you're young, and chances are you'll be that way all of your life, and if you don't, you'll find it exceedingly hard to stop it. Sin gets hold of people. Sin becomes the master of people. Sin is hard to shake. Sin is hard to put behind us and to get rid of it. And even if we get rid of it and we quit it and we have faith enough and moral courage and strength enough to quit it, the scars of it will always be there. Heard a long time ago about a father, a farmer. He had this boy who was turned out to be an unruly son, an ingrate, unthankful, disobedient, arrogant to his daddy. And the old daddy down in the feed room of the barn, every time his boy got in trouble, he began to take a nail and just tack it in the wall. Just nail it in the wall. I don't know whether it gave him a relief. It wasn't necessarily to try to remember everything bad his boy did, but maybe it gave him relief just to drive a nail. And the boy found out after some years that that's what his daddy done. He saw all those nails in the wall down there in the feed room of the barn one day, and inquired, and so the daddy and the mama told the boy, son, every time you got into a problem, your dad drove a nail in the wall down there. And the boy tried to change his life around, so the story went. And one by one, he went down there and he pulled those nails out of that wall. But he said to his daddy on his dying bed, the daddy's dying bed, Father, I'm sorry that I caused you so much grief and so much heartache. He said, I'm trying to do better. But he said, you know, Dad, I go down to the barn, and he said, the scars are still there. He said, the nails are out of the wall, but the scars are there. The holes are still there. And young folks, you're not going to remove the holes. You may do wrong. All of us may do wrong. Older folks do wrong. I'm not just talking down to young folks. I'm talking to everybody. I'm talking to me. We all do wrong, and we may repent, and we may change our mind, which we ought to, and we may plead for mercy and ask God for His grace and His forgiveness and ask each other for forgiveness, and that forgiveness ought to be forthcoming. And when forgiveness takes place, forgetfulness takes place. God forgives and He forgets. He said, I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. God forgives it and He forgets it and it's over with. We don't forget that easy. I'd rather fall in the hands of God any time than I had in the hands of men. God will be more merciful and more forgiving and more understanding and more gracious than human beings will be. Oh, we can be harder on one another than God ever will be hard on us. The Almighty loves us and He'll forgive us. But let me tell you something, dear ones, any age of us, the scars will always be there. You'll never get rid of the scars. And young people, you rejoice in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw nigh, and thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. You remember your Creator. You rejoice in the days of your youth. You are living the best days of your life, young folks. If you have parents who are godly people, and parents, family life, good family life, and rearing good children, a lot of people are still doing. Not nearly as many as ought to, and I wish that we could. But if you're going to rear good children, basic to all of that is for them to have a secure, stable family life and environment of growing up with a daddy and a mother who really love each other. If your child grows up in a home where there is bickering and shouting and yelling and fussing and growling and fault finding and inconsideration and all kind of unthankfulness between a husband and his wife, and the children listen to that and they see that, they are never going to know what good home life is and how to conduct themselves as a married person. If you want to rear good children, it begins with good parents. It begins in a good, stable, serene, calm, gentle, kind, forgiving family environment. And if you don't furnish that for your child, then you will not have well-adjusted children spiritually. And you will not have children who appreciate the value of a father and mother who really care. If they don't see a good marriage in their own parents, how will they know how to contract a good marriage? That's where it begins. That's part of it. But young people, you have an appreciative heart and a thankful heart. Don't try to grow up too soon. Continue your studies. Contend with them. Learn your books. Get an education. Because I'm here to tell you, you're going to need every bit of knowledge that you can gain and garner and remember in this life. You're going to need to know everything that you can possibly find out. The world is getting more technical all the time. The world is getting more educated all the time for people who make it, for people who make a living, for people who have some degree of this world's goods. You're going to have to be an educated person to do it. If you're not willing to put forth the effort, if you're not willing to study your lessons month by month and year by year through 12 grades and on into college, if you're not willing to do that, you'll never make it in this old world anymore. The jobs in the industry, going out and finding a job, getting more difficult are all the time. And if you've got to have the know-how, now that's from that standpoint. But what you need to be doing more than that is to be cultivating righteousness and true holiness in your life, of being acquainted with your parents of God's will, being consistent and true in your worship to God, truly letting the kingdom of God come first in your life. And parents, you have to teach your children that. If they don't see that, if they see their mother and daddy with interest more valuable than the church and more valuable than worship and Bible study, they're not going to have any appreciation for it, no more than you do. And so we've got to put the kingdom of God first in our lives. You need to teach your children that and show them the right ways of the Lord. I don't stand before here you bragging and as a paragon of virtue. But before God, I can say one thing honestly. My wife and I never deliberately, willfully missed any service of worship of the church. We have never. Sometimes I've taught and I preached when I was so sick I could hardly stand up. But we were at worship and we had our children at worship. We always had our daily devotionals. We had our family Bible readings. We had our family prayers. The children took part in those prayers and they did their share of the reading. That was a part of 30 minutes every evening that we spent. The television was turned off. We didn't allow our children to watch. Didn't have all this junk that they have on there now. But anyway, there were just those things that we are absolutely necessary if we're going to be spiritual-minded people and rear spiritual-minded children. This is what Solomon is talking about. He says, while you're a young person, don't ruin your life. Rejoice when you're at home with your parents. Be thankful. Be grateful to God for your blessings. And rejoice in the days of your youth and use the days of your youth as the preparation for a lifetime, for adulthood, and for growing up to be a man or a woman who can live with yourself in good conscience, who can live with a husband or wife in purity and godliness and holiness, and who can rear children and who can teach your children to be godly people. Rejoice. He said, therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart and evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. Childhood and youth can be vanity. Doesn't have to be. If you will remove sorrow from your heart and evil from your flesh. Young folks, if you at this present juncture of your life, we have youngsters in here all different stages and ages. But if you are doing and thinking wrong things, remove sorrow from your heart and evil from your flesh. If you're doing something wrong, sinful wrong, and you know it is, stop it. Turn from it. Quit it. No human being that your friend or your boyfriend or your girlfriend or a schoolmate, no human being is worth you ruining your life for and going to hell for and being miserable all the days you live here in this world and being miserable for all eternity. No one's worth that. The boy, the girl, the man, or the woman hasn't yet walked on 2 feet. Who's worth that? Of making me or you a miserable wreck in sin, of wrecking my life, of ruining my soul and ruining my reputation and ruining my good name and ruining my influence and hurting me and hurting my family and hurting my parents and hurting my wife or hurting my husband, my children. Nobody's worth that. Remove sorrow from your heart. That's the sorrow that comes by doing wrong. And you remove that through forgiveness, through repentance. And evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. So said the wise man. And then he said, remember. Remember thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Before the evil days come and the years draw nigh, and thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Let me give you some examples from the Bible. Joseph was a youngster, 17 years old. We'd call him a teenager. His mother was dead. His father loved him. He was the 11th of 12 sons of Jacob. 17 years old, by that days, the early days of his growing up, he was a person who believed in God. And so God gave Joseph dreams. You remember how it was that the stars did obeisance to him, and how the shocks of grain in the dream did obeisance to his. And he didn't know what that meant, and his brothers hated him and called him the dreamer because he had these dreams, and whereby it always seemed in the dreams that his brothers bowed down to him, and they despised him. And they despised him because his daddy seemed to dote on him, and I imagine the reason that the daddy doted on him is because he was a good boy. If parents have some children who are not good, and they have one child who is doing right, and who is obedient, and who is respectable, it's hard not to really show a little favoritism toward that child. If you see a child that's really trying and wants to do right to God and to the parents, it's kind of difficult for a parent not to show a little favoritism. I don't know why Jacob did, but I rather guess it is because Joseph was Rachel's son, first, and secondly, because Joseph as a boy was a God-fearing boy. But when he is 17 years old, his brothers got a chance. They got him away from home. They were away from home tending sheep, and the daddy had little enough judgment to send Joseph to go see how the boys were doing. And he was 75 miles away from home. Jacob was down at Hebron in the southern part of the land, and Joseph went all the way up to Shechem and then up to Dothan, looking for his brothers, and found them 75 miles from home, tending to the flock, and they got their chance. And they sold him as a slave down into Egypt. Reuben didn't agree to that. Reuben was gone when these Ishmaelite slave traders came by, but Judah was the worst one, and he's the ringleader in the bunch, and he sold his brother into slavery. And when Reuben came back and found that Joseph was gone, he was so perturbed and so upset, but his fault was that he entered into the lie with his brothers. And they took Joseph's coat and they tore it up and they dipped it in the blood of an animal, and they went home to their daddy after a while and they said, is this Joseph's coat? They let their old daddy draw his own conclusion. They didn't say, this is Joseph's coat. Is this Joseph's coat? Looked like it. Joseph has been torn. Jacob said, he's been torn by the wild beast. My son been killed. And you know, they didn't tell him any different. And they saw their daddy begin to mourn and to weep and to cry and to pray. And so much so that he said, I'll go down to my grave. I'll go to Sheol. I'll go into the realm of departed spirits, mourning for my son Joseph. It devastated him. He was 115 years old when that happened, Jacob was. It devastated him. And there stood those 10 boys. And they saw their daddy cry and weep and pray and mourn and never get over it. His heart was broken. He had lost his boy. And those 10 boys stood there year after year after year and never told their daddy the truth. and 22 long years went by before their daddy learned the truth about where Joseph was and how he got down into Egypt, and how these 10 boys who had been at home all the time had lied to him and deceived him and let him mourn for his boy for 22 long years when his boy had been sold as a slave. But that boy was sold as a slave down into Egypt and sold to Potiphar, the king's executioner, the captain of the king's guard, the one who had charge of the royal prisoners, the one who put the prisoners to death when Pharaoh gave the word. And Potiphar bought this 17-year-old Hebrew boy and saw that he had a prize because he was a God-fearing boy. He was honest and he was trustworthy and he worked hard and he was dependable. And you turn something over to Joseph and it'd be done right and he'd tell the truth about it. Young folks, if you'll do the same thing, if you'll be honest and tell the truth, if you'll work hard, if you'll have some get up and go about you, if you'll have some energy about you, if you'll study hard and whatever you do, you'll do with all your might and do it well, and you'll tell the truth and be honest, the world will beat a path to your door. But if you're sorry and you're lazy and you're indolent and you won't study and you won't work and you can't even do the simplest little old chores around the house without continual nagging by your mom on you all the time about make up your bed or clean up your room or hang up your clothes, if you can't do any better than that, you'll never amount to a hill of peas. And you mamas, if you allow your children to do that, something's wrong with you. You teach your children good habits and let them learn to care for themselves and clean up after themselves and give them chores to do, and daddies and mothers expect that of their children. But Joseph had another quality. Joseph, with all of his other good traits, he was moral. He knew that it was wrong to commit adultery. It was wrong to commit fornication. The patriarchs knew that. That came along in the law of Moses many centuries later, a century or two later. But Joseph knew it was wrong. And when Potiphar's wife approached him in the absence of any other person in the house, and she tried to entice that young Hebrew to lay with her, he would not. God would know it. And she's his master's wife. He said, "My master has not withheld anything from me. He's given me charge over everything. But I cannot do this to my master. I'll not do it to you. I'll not do it to him. I'll not do it to myself. I'll not do it to God." And he refused to do it. And you know that story. One day she enticed him even more strongly. And he refused and he left the house. And he left his garment in the house. Where he went about his overseers, he was steward of his master's house. And he went out of that house that day and he left his cloak. And that vicious, evil, mean, wicked, ungodly woman, when her husband came home, she said, "Look what this Hebrew been in this house, tried to force me." And she lied about him. And I guess Potiphar knew his wife about as well as he knew Joseph. He had to do something. His wife comes accused the slave of trying to force her to assault her. But it's interesting he didn't put Joseph to death. He could have cut his head off at the snap of your finger. But he didn't do it. He put him in prison. He saved his life. And I'm rather guessing that's because he knew his wife pretty well. And knew what kind of a woman she was. And there Joseph prospered. And he went into prison. I don't know how long he was there. I don't know how long he was in Potiphar's house. I don't know how long he was in prison. But I do know that he sold as a slave when he was 17. And when he was age 30, he was prime minister of the land. One day he was a prisoner down in the prison. And the next day he was sitting at the right hand of Pharaoh, the second most important man in the kingdom of Egypt in that day. Why? Young people, I'll tell you why. Because God can use young folks like that, and he can use older folks like that. And God will direct your ways, and he will guide your paths, and he will overrule in your life for good. And his eye will be upon you, just like it's upon the sparrow, that the sparrow cannot fall without his knowledge, and the hair of your head cannot fall without his knowledge. God knows you, and he knows me, and his eye is ever upon us. And you may be sure that He is able to choose our changes for us, and He is able to guide us into righteousness, and He is able to make all things come out all right at the end of the way, and He is able to preserve your goings out and your comings in if you will do His will. But if you refuse God, and if you put Him at arm's length away from you, and you say to Him, I will not serve God, I'm not going to be a child of God, I'm not going to be obedient to Him, and I'm going to have an ugly, tacky attitude toward my parents, and I'm not going to be appreciative, and I'm going to be unthankful and ungrateful, if that's the kind of disposition that you are cultivating, or do cultivate and intend to, you are in for trouble all your life and heartache and sorrow. And you're the one that opened the door. It'll not be your parents, it'll not be this preacher, it'll not be your brethren in the church. It will be you who will open the door to good or to evil, to right or to wrong. Daniel was probably about the age of Joseph when Daniel was taken into slavery, into captivity in Babylon, removed from Jerusalem. He was of the royal seed. I don't know just how he was connected to the royal family, but the Bible says he was of the royal seed. And in Nebuchadnezzar's first expedition against Jerusalem in 606-605 B.C., Daniel was among the young, choice young men of the Jews who was taken over into captivity in Babylon, 400 miles over to the east across the Arabian desert. And Nebuchadnezzar gave charge to the master of his eunuchs that you take of the choice young men of the Hebrews and you teach them all of the wisdom and all of the skills and the language of the Chaldeans. I'm going to use these young men as liaisons between the palace and the government and these Jewish people in captivity. I'm going to train them in the ways of the Chaldeans. Seven times in Daniel chapter 1, it is said that Daniel and his companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were committed into the charge of the master of the eunuchs. That means that Daniel was emasculated. It means that his reproductive powers were taken from him. It means that he would never marry, that he would never bear children. He was made a eunuch. Jesus said the same thing in Matthew chapter 19 concerning marriage after Peter said, after Jesus had given the law on marriage and divorce and remarriage, Peter said, who can bear this? And Jesus said, people can bear it. The law of God regarding marriage and divorce and remarriage is easily borne by people who want to do God's will. But Jesus said in that context, Matthew chapter 19 and verse 12, He said, some are born eunuchs, some are made eunuchs by men, and some make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of God's sake. Paul and Barnabas were two of those. They never married. They had a right to bear about a wife. They had a right to be married and have a family. They never did. They made themselves eunuchs, as it were, for the kingdom of God's sake, to give themselves completely to the Lord. But here was Daniel. Daniel was made so by men and would never have a family, would never have offspring. And so that's made clear in chapter 1. But listen, let me tell you something about this young man. Here he is in a foreign country, taken captive from his people and from his city, his nation, taken as a slave and placed in the king's court over there, physically emasculated, and now he's going to be taught the learning of the Chaldeans. What did he do? He made up his mind about something. He made up his mind that he would observe the law of Moses, that he would not defile himself with the king's dainties. He made up his mind that he would not drink the king's drink, the intoxicants of that day, the drugged portions, the things that got people high, the things that got people drunk. He would not partake of them. And so he didn't. And when the master of the eunuchs came to him and said, here's what the king said, Daniel and his companion said, let us have water, and let us eat the soup, let us eat the vegetables, the pulse it's called, but that means vegetable dishes. And if we don't fare better that way, then after trying trial day period, well then do something else, but give us a try. And the master of the eunuchs was reluctant to do that, but he agreed to it, and he did. And at the end of 10 days, he came and looked at these Hebrew young men, and they were fairer in complexion, and they were stronger in their bodies, and they're more alert in their eyes than all those who had been eating all of the king's dannies and all of those Gentile foods and all of those drug portions and all of that drink and wine and so on. And so the master of the eunuchs allowed Daniel, because he and his companions had convictions about something. Young people learn to say no. In a church where I preached for 17 years in Port Arthur, Texas, we had a lot of young people to grow up in those years, to come and to go. And by and large, they were the finest group of young people I ever knew in my life. Only a time or two did we ever have a problem with young children, young people growing up in that 17-year period. But one was sort of a backdoor thing that happened. This sweet girl, pretty girl, she had been in the Bible classes. She had been taught by her mother and dad. She had been taught by me and from the pulpit and teachers in Bible classes. Young people, stay away from the drugs. Don't go with anybody. Don't go anywhere where they're using drugs, beer or whiskey or any of the pills or anything. LSD was really the vogue then. This girl knew better than this. We had always told our children, all of our children, don't ever let somebody hand you a pill. Leave it alone. This girl one day was at school. She was a senior in high school, and she wasn't feeling well. And some old boy says, I have something better than aspirin. It'll make you feel so good if you just... And she lost her judgment. She didn't think. And he slipped her some LSD and she took it. Within 3 hours, she was hallucinating. She was rushed to the hospital. For 3 days, she was in a coma and hallucinated when she would come in and out of it. The doctors in Port Arthur told her parents and then told her, chances are, because of this drug that you've taken, if you ever bear a child, it might be a child with a deformity. That was the quality of this particular kind of drug. She got over that in some weeks. Finished her education, went on to college, and married after a while. After 3 or 4 years of marriage, she had a child. And that little boy is deformed. That little boy doesn't have proper mental capacity. That little boy has a crippled right hand and arm. All because a young woman, several years before, forgot all that she had heard, all she had been instructed, all the warnings that had been given to her, she forgot it. And she took a pill. She didn't know what it was. And she pays the price to this day. She'll never get over it as long as she lives. She'll never have another child. And that can happen to you. I've talked long enough, didn't realize it, talking so long. But on and on I could go from the Bible with people who had convictions, with people who had made mistakes. The prodigal son made mistakes, Luke chapter 15. He came back home. But it wasn't always the same. It was with his daddy, but it wasn't with his brother. And most of the time, when there's sin in the family, it won't ever be the same. There can be forgiveness, but there will not be the same anymore. Sin changes things, people. Sin changes things in marriages, if a husband or wife are untrue to each other. Sin changes things between parents and their children, and between brothers and sisters. Sin changes things in the church. It'll never be the same if we commit sin. The scars will always be there. I appeal to every one of you, older and younger, parents, grandparents, children, young people, live a moral life. Do your best. Serve God. Rejoice while you're young. Have happy days. But prepare yourself for life. Remove sorrow from your heart, evil from your flesh. Turn away from wrong. If you're doing it now, quit it. If you're not doing it, don't ever start. and remember your God and your Father in heaven while you're young. That's the only way it'll ever be. You can have a much, much greater chance at happiness in this world, and certainly salvation in heaven to come if you'll do that. I thank you. May God bless you. If you need to respond, would you do so now while we're standing and singing?